All right, well, I'm just going to get started because I'm very excited to be here. My name is Tim Ferriss. I am author of The 4-Hour Workweek. And thank you all for coming. This is a very, very tough time spot. There are a lot of good panels, but I think you'll be happy that you came to this one, I hope. So this is The Art of Speed, and we're going to be discussing with three amazing panelists, and I'll chime in whenever I need to validate myself. We'll be talking about how to do big things in the shortest time possible. So we have a number of people. I'll let them introduce themselves who've done some very, very impressive things, oftentimes more than once. So we're going to jump right into it. I'm going to allow 15 minutes for audience Q&A at the end. And I'm hoping that we'll have a lot of fun and you'll have some real takeaways that you can apply to whatever it is you do now or that you do next. So without further ado, I will let the panelists take a minute or two to introduce themselves. Mike?
So my name is Mike Cassidy. I'm an entrepreneur. I've been the CEO and co-founder of three startups, all in different spaces. The first one was a computer telephony company, and we started with $1,500. I put in $500, and each of my two friends put in $500. And it's a way to link telephones and computers together to do like touch tone questions, and you get answers read back to you. And we sold that one for $13 million. Second one was Direct Hit, which was an internet search engine. Most of you haven't heard of it. It was actually a search engine that provided results for Microsoft, AOL, Lycos, kind of behind the scenes, powered by Direct Hit. And that was, I guess, one of the reasons why I got invited to be on the panel. It was very quick. In 500 days, it grew to a value of $500 million. And then the third one was Xfire, which was an instant messenger for PC video gamers. It let gamers sort of see what games their friends are playing. Click on your friend's name, you get launched into the same game your friend is on. And that one was relatively quick, too. In about 2 years after we launched, MTV bought it for $100 million. And now I'm trying to find idea number four.
I'm Callie Lewis. I host a video show called Geek Brief TV with my husband, Neil. And we decided in November of 2005 that we were going to quit our day jobs and podcast full time, and so we did. 5 months to the date that we started, we announced that we were quitting our day jobs and going full time thanks to Podshow. And we thought it would take a lot longer, but we figured out a way to make it happen within that 5 months.
What are some of your numbers, Callie, just so we can get an idea?
Well, 3 weeks into it, we released the first show on December 23rd of 2005. 3 weeks in, we were getting shut down from our hosting company. We had 3,000 downloads, and then a month it went to 50,000. The next month it went to 100,000. The next month it went to 300,000, and by the fifth month we were at a million downloads a month, and it just kept going.
Yeah, that's fast. All right, Evan.
My name is Evan Williams. I'm co-founder of three companies like Mike, or five, depending on which ones you count. Unlike Mike, they
just
all
count
took
the good ones.
They all took much longer and sold for less money. The first one, Blogger, or the first one I count is Blogger / Pyro Labs, which was a big deal here in 2000 for those old time South by Southwesters. I'm also co-founder and currently chief product officer of Twitter, which is...
How many of you guys heard about this panel through Twitter? Anybody? Okay, we got one. Well, that shows you how many people are reading my Twitter.
So that's grown a little faster, and that's it.
Cool.
Until later.
So I have not really asked any of the questions that I'll be asking these panelists because I really wanted it to all be a surprise to me as well. And this is just a real selfish way for me to get all these three people in one place so I can get the answers that I want. So I also wanted to point out that the 4-Hour Workweek really hit the tipping point at South by Southwest last year. It's hard to believe that it's only been 11 months since that point. But it's really what led to everything that followed. And I really believe that due to South by Southwest, without any offline advertising or PR the 4-Hour Work Week hit the New York Times and Wall Street Journal in the first week of its release. So it really shows you the concentration of a digerati and maybe just prolific talkers there are here. I want to ask Mike the first question. So to give you guys an idea of what FAST means, this is a printout of a presentation that Mike gives, which is aptly titled Speed as the Primary Startup Strategy. So what does FAST mean? I have a timeline here for launching company and explore ideas, 2 weeks, raise money, 1 day, hire core team and open office, 2 weeks, build product, 3 months. All right. So this is a compression of a process that would might generally take 23 to 27 months. So Mike, I want to ask just to start off, what are some things that people can do to move their company faster?
Okay, sure. So I believe in compressing all of the phases of building a company, and some of the things I like to try to do are like you heard the raise money in 1 day sort of thing. I try to get all the decision makers. I require all the decision makers in the room. So when you're talking to a VC or whatever, you'll say, "Sure, I'd love to come present, but can you please make sure all the decision makers are there at the meeting?" Now, some people might say, "Well, forget that," but a lot of them will be like, wow, they must be onto something, you know. And so you don't get this, you pitch and they say, we have to talk to other partners or whatever. And also try to have, you know, all the VC meetings on the same day. If you're going to meet with three VCs, meet with all of them the same day. And so it's going to be a compressed system. And, you know, try to get the same day close. Just basically say, you know, get a term sheet. Like the first direct hit, we pitched at 8:15 in the morning. Draper Fisher Jurvetson gave us a term sheet at 4:30 the same day. Just sort of really, and go in with a meeting with all, everything lined up. You know, a customer, if you can have a you know, something from a customer saying we'd buy it. I love the if-then contract. A customer says, well, yeah, if you build a search engine that has, you know, 50 millisecond response time and, you know, we'll beat the quality of our product by, you know, 3-1 in any survey we do, then we'll buy it. We'll do that contract. Then you walk into the VC with that contract. In terms of hiring, I like to try to speed up the hiring process. I will do reference checks while the hiring is going on with other hiring managers. And at the end of the day, with sort of a one-day process of interviews, I will say to someone, great, we'd love to have you. Here's the offer. Are you going to accept? And they'll say, well, wait, I didn't expect this. And I'll say, okay, I don't want to rush you. Sleep on it overnight and let me know 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. So just speed up the whole thing. You know, product development. Totally a believer in, you know, rapid development, incremental releases, you know, release quickly. As Tim pointed out, we released a product within 3.5 months of starting all three, of deciding on the right product at all three companies. And then for Xfire, we did a new product release every 2 weeks. And it just sort of enforces a discipline inside the company of you quickly get feedback from the users and can adapt. So anyway, those are some of the things.
One thing I want to just to ask, because this is something I really found interesting. I guess it was related to raising money. You said that there's always something urgent happening within the VC, and if you're not that urgent thing, then you're in trouble or something along those lines. So really, it's not just time. So we could talk for a few days about the definition of time, but perception of time. So really scheduling things, planning things in such a way that you can determine how time is perceived and how the importance of what you do is perceived in relation to that. So Ev, the next question is for you. Why do you think, whether it's Twitter or Blogger, you can choose either one, why do you think they've grown as quickly as they have?
I think there's a few reasons. One is that they're by nature communications or self-expression tools. So by using them, other people find out about them, and you may call it viral marketing. Some people are much better at viral marketing, really making that a science. But I think just by the nature of things that are kind of megaphones for people, then they've had that benefit. But the other thing that I think is especially the case in Twitter is getting critical mass. I think all social tools, social networks, are in that broad category, grow most quickly when they get critical mass. And if you were here at South by Southwest last year, Twitter took a big leap in popularity among the group of people who come to conferences like this. And it had been launched for at least 6 months at that time, but There's something that happens when word of mouth, you know, you hear about it from one person is one thing, you hear about it from three people who you know, then there's suddenly a have to be on this thing. And I think you can take that into account in your when you're targeting. That wasn't exactly planned, but I think if you see where your product is working and then go toward that market, some you might have the opposite instinct to say, okay, now we want to go to another market because it's working there. But I think it'll have a multiplying effect if you go towards where it's working. And so you want to get, and Facebook did this brilliantly by you know, launching in colleges. Then, as everybody knows, they got critical mass in the college in lightning speed because that's the only people on there. So similarly in Twitter happens to be popular in Japan. So we're looking at Japan and saying, well, how can we make it easier and get more and more people in Japan? Because then it's much more powerful than trying to go everywhere at once. It'll grow much more slowly that way.
How did, because I remember South by Southwest last year and seeing Twitter on the screens as people were Twittering. Is that how you launched it here, so to speak, or what was the real first explosion when you started having these people adopt?
I wish I knew. Okay. Exactly.
I mean, was it like a more of a sponsorship where you had it up on the screens and that is what did it, or did you have a presentation earlier in the day?
It was just the screens. It was a combination of factors, though. I mean, I don't think that would have worked by itself if we didn't have a large number of people already on it who were coming here.
Right.
And it was just sort of perfect for this particular event because it's so distributed and with all the parties at night and people, it just happened to have a lot of utility here. So it's a combination of the people who are already on it, using it, getting here, seeing the screens, hearing about it, and then it happened to be very useful in this situation.
And all the people that were using it last year were the big names in technology too. Did you go after them or did they come to
Twitter?
That was
kind of luck. I mean, this is all just looking back and thinking how we got lucky, but... if I were to do it again, I mean, definitely for technologies that are about, again, the communications or the personal expression, if you can get those highly influential people who others want to follow, who, by the way, REM just joined Twitter, they're Twittering REM HQ. So, you know, that's definitely a marketing strategy that happened to work for us within the sort of geek world, and hopefully will work at a broader level as well.
Not sure what that word was. Was it a conscious decision as far as choosing a product or developing a product for personal expression, partially because it would have that effect of self-perpetuating?
Not for me. Twitter wasn't my idea. I was the CEO of the company that it was born in, Odeo, and we just liked it. I always just want to work on products that I like using, so... they've happened to be things that sort of have some natural built-in marketing angle, but I don't even know if I'm that good at exploiting that.
I just want to point something out too, which Evan just made an emphasis, and that is following the market that's responding. I think is critically important. So with the 4-hour work week as an example, there's a lot of built-in resistance to something called the 4-hour work week because it's like between the rotisserie chicken and the spray on hair at 3 a.m. on TV. It sounds like 6-minute abs. But I noticed that the pain point of overwhelm was so acute among a lot of technologists that they were drawn to this low information diet idea. And most people only know the book because of either personal outsourcing or the low information diet. The low information diet was a matter of following the market that responded to it. So people are like, oh, did you have this grand, like, 20-point plan for launching the book? And I was like, well, no, I basically got drunk with a lot of bloggers and talked about the low information diet, and that was the concept that stuck. So I followed that. The personal outsourcing, so this is also related to what Ev just said about, you know, I liked it, we liked it, and it was sort of a side project that ended up becoming really popular. The personal outsourcing, I just decided to push to its ridiculous extreme by outsourcing my online dating. I don't know if anybody heard about this. I had teams of people in India and Croatia competing to put dates in my calendar. Since I live in San Jose, I need the help. And some people within my publisher were like, no, don't do that. Don't do it. Focus on the book. And it ended up being what propelled the book in part to where it is. So Callie, I've had a very stumbling effort to do video here and there. And it's been, you know, I'd say at best tolerable and at worst pretty awful. What do you think contributed to your success? I mean, the numbers that you have are very uncommon. A lot of people are getting into video and podcasting. But what do you think are some of the factors that contributed, some of the key decisions that led to the popularity?
Two words: community and passion. Okay. The way we build an audience, our method for building an audience, is very much like running for political office, I guess you could say. It's about getting out there, meeting people, shaking hands, getting in a virtual world, of course, but getting out there and meeting people, and then they go out and tell other people, so it's word of mouth. When I talk about community, one of the first things that comes to mind is forums and, you know, that kind of thing. You're the expert. So if you're in the tech world, or if you're in the wood making business or whatever it is, then that is your world and you are the expert in that field. So I always say, go out and involve yourself in the community, get involved in forums, and don't go out there and say, hey, I'm an expert, come to me, look at my site. You know, that's not the way to do it. But you go out there and you present yourself as, you don't even present yourself, but if somebody has a question about something that you know the answer to, hey, I know the answer to this, so I'll answer the question. And all you need is a signature with your website, your name, what you do. That's all you need. And I really encourage people not to go out and say, hey, you know, this is who I am, pay attention to me, because that doesn't work, because you see those people all the time and you say, oh, I don't want to pay attention to that. And so it's really about just answering people's questions, involving yourself in the community, and being that expert, that person that people go to. And the other thing I said was passion. Neil and I have never known passion like we knew with Geek Brief. We, and everybody here, you guys know passion. It's what propels business forward. And, I mean, we were focused in such a way that there was no ifs, ands, or buts about it. This was going to happen. And you can, I think you can fake that. I think you can tell yourself you have the passion, but it has to be real. It has to be, you know, that focus that you just, oh, it's so hard to explain almost, but you guys know what I'm talking about, right? It's something that just pushes you forward, that it doesn't matter how much sleep you don't have. It doesn't matter about anything else in the world. You're just going to go after it and you're going to make it happen.
How do you translate that in a virtual world? So let's just say you have sort of podcast one, podcast two, podcast three,
mm-hmm.
and you happen to be three. How do you...
In ranking, you mean?
No. Just ABC.
Okay.
And you're interacting with your community, developing that community. What does that actually mean on the page? I mean, if I go to visit your site, what are some of the characteristics that in the early stages that propelled it that you wouldn't find at other with other podcasters or videocasters, or maybe common mistakes that they make that you guys maybe picked up on earlier on?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily about mistakes. It's about community. It's about... I love our viewers. I love meeting them. I love talking to them. And I do that in so many different ways. That's a forum, whether it's mine, other tech community forums, Twitter. Twitter is a huge part of what we do and how we build our community, because we talk and, you know, they at reply us. And it's a conversation. And that's what I love about Twitter. Oops, sorry. I got a little close. And that's what I did. You know, I got out there and I talked to the people. Mm-hmm. If you're going to build an audience, you need to be your audience, I think.
Mm-hmm. How do you think it scaled so quickly? Because, I mean, if you look at the numbers, right? I mean, you're doubling in some cases over mm-hmm. a matter of weeks. So you're of course not going out and meeting, necessarily communicating with all right. these people directly.
But
why do you think it spread so quickly in that fashion?
Well, I think we create a loyal audience.
Okay.
And those loyal audience members will go out and tell other people. And every day I get emails from people saying, that they went to their, they found the show, they watched back episodes, all 300, what are we at, 24 now. They did a marathon, a Geek Brief marathon, yep. And then they take that to their office, mm-hmm. and they say, hey, you have to watch this, you have to watch mm-hmm. this. And so it's really word of mouth, and it's that community and getting them involved with other people in your audience. Mm-hmm. It's a meshing.
Okay, this actually brings up a really good point, which is that building a good audience or community, at least in my experience, which is limited, but is not about necessarily reaching the most people. And what I mean by that is, and it's analogous to South by Southwest. So when people are like, oh my God, how did you meet so many people at South by Southwest? I actually did not meet that many people. What I ended up doing was spending a lot of time with a handful of people and developing a really close bond with them over the span of several days. And then those few people went out and ended up spreading the word to other people. So if you meet 1,000 people, but the interaction is really marginal, no one's going to talk about you. But if you talk to 10, who then take their enthusiasm and pass it on to another, 10 each, to 100, and then it multiplies out that way.
Yeah.
So I found that, for example, when I launched my blog a few months before the book, I had a lot of interaction with my readers, and I enjoyed the blog. And it had a very, very similar effect.
And you're also good at getting to the influencers. It's just one thing.
Yeah, and well, here's okay. So I think this may be something that people are curious about, because so how did I end up on all these blogs? I think part of it is that I didn't necessarily find the influencers directly. And it wasn't all this big, big plan, but what ended up happening is if I send an email to, let's say, Robert Scoble, I know Robert now, met him for the first time at the blog house last year at CES, but if you send an email to Robert Scoble or to Mike Arrington, you're competing in the busiest channel, all right? That's what everyone does. So you have 10 million email to compete with. In person is by far the emptiest channel. And rather than being a traffic bigot and just going to try to meet, let's say, an Arrington or a Scoble, I was perfectly happy instead to go to the thought leaders. All right, so the traffic leaders and the thought leaders are not necessarily the same people. And I'm a big fan of Brian Oberkirk, and he's friends with a lot of the A-listers, and just ended up doing this really fun long interview with Brian. And guess what? A lot of the top traffic leaders read his blog, so it's an indirect way to get this endorsement essentially that allows the traffic leaders to then link to you if they think what you have to say is of value. This is for Mike. As far as product development, let's say, or producing good ideas, what do you find slows that down, or what are your keys to accelerating that process?
So this is one I think Evan actually nailed, and that's start with a very clean, simple feature set. Don't spend 6 months doing an elaborate spec what you think the user base is going to like, and sort of stay inside your cave and then convince yourselves it's going to be great and throw it out there, and then you're going to be shocked what they do like and don't like. But just like Evan talked about, you launch with a simple feature set and then just watch what features people like. I mean, with X-Fire, again, we were doing a release every 2 weeks. And most of the product feature upgrades were coming from user feedback. And they would just give you lots of feedback, And it's very easy just to watch the user feedback, what features they want to see. And also, usability testing, everyone talks about it, but gosh, I would say 95% of the people who even talk about it don't really do it. Just go to some random person who's never seen your product before, sit down with them as they're using it for the first time, and just tell them, talk out loud. Everyone talks about it. People just don't do it. And if you got an engineering team, bring the engineering team with you, and tell them they can't say a word. They just have to listen. But it's just so stunning to see what you'll see from that. So that's what we do.
And from what do you find are some of the most common mistakes? Because so Mike is now entrepreneur in residence at Benchmark. So has had at Benchmark Capital. So you've had an opportunity to see from the other side of the table, I guess, a lot of different deals and companies and founders. What are some of the most common mistakes besides sort of neglecting the usability and testing that Are there any other really common mistakes that you see people make that slow them down? It doesn't necessarily have to be related to product development, but what are the biggest time sucks that you observe?
I think people spend a lot of building the team is the tough nut on this one, because it's absolutely critical you build a good team. And it's not just a cliche, everyone knows this, but how do you actually do it, and how do you find the people on the team, and how valuable are the 20 ex developers who one awesome developer is worth 20 sort of normal developers. I think people can get hung up in, wow, I can't pay that much for that I can't pay an extra $10,000 for that person because whatever. I mean, for someone who's that strong, you should be doing whatever you can. And it's not just money too. It's really finding these people and passionately recruiting them. I mean, I invite people I'm hiring over to my house for dinner, and they can bring their significant other with them. And I send them flowers to their house, saying, congratulations, welcome to the team. Some people can make mistakes in not putting enough energy into getting those key people. And also the classic mistake that people know about is, we're kind of in a hurry, we'll take this person, they're pretty good, not spectacular, but pretty good, good enough. And it sort of always comes back to haunt you when you do that. Anytime I ever am recruiting and someone says, oh, you got to hire that person, I'll do whatever it takes to get that person, someone like that. And anytime someone says, yeah, they're pretty good, it's pretty much off my list. So.
Thanks. No, actually, one more thing, because I think this is... when somebody arrives, you've just hired them, they arrive for the first day, what happens?
Okay, so that's another sort of pet peeve of mine is...
Mike has a lot of pet peeves.
So what I can't stand is, someone shows up to work, they're really eager to go, and the classic thing is, oh, sorry, your PC's not quite ready yet, your email account's not quite ready yet, so why don't you just read these manuals for one? It's like, forget it. So at my companies, we try to get all the paperwork out of the way before, this fill out your whatever it is, I don't even know these forms, your S1 1099, whatever forms. Fill out beforehand, and then you absolutely have to have your PC set up, your source control login, your email address, your phone number, your phone directories on your page, your project list is sitting there when you show up, and you meet at the very first moment with your manager and say, okay, here's expectations. Talk about setting a tone for the pace. When you walk in an environment like that, it's like, wow, these guys are serious. I mean, here's the project plan, and here's the projected timeline. And that's so different than what I see in many other cases. So.
All right. That's number one on my list. God, I was in a storage area networking for 1-2 years. And I remember when there was a new sales manager brought in, and the first thing he did was he dropped basically a phone directory on my desk, and he said, okay, start with A and start making phone calls. I was like, it's time to find another job. So, Evan, related to sort of spreading the message or facilitating the dissemination of something like Twitter, and I'm also fascinated by your product development process, though, if there is something as formal as a process. But could you just comment on maybe some of the things that you try to focus on, whether it's within product development or facilitating the distribution and dissemination of your products?
Features. I'd love to hear how you do features. How do you do your brainstorming sessions? Who does it? Who's in the room? And how do you decide what to put in and out?
It's pretty chaotic. I mean, there's Twitter right now is 17 people, and I mean, everybody thinks of features, and sometimes engineers just sneak them in. They're out there somewhere. What we're trying to develop more of a process, but I don't want process to get in the way. So you're absolutely right about user testing. Everybody talks about it. Nobody does it. We don't do it, but we talk about it. The nice thing about having a product like Twitter, and I always go back to what do we want as users? You can analyze a lot of things, and you can worry about is this going to bother users? Are people going to like this? And I find that it brings a lot of clarity sometimes if you just say, well, what do you want? Your user, what do you want? And you can take that too far because you in the company are geeks to begin with, and then you're experts on the product and you want some fringe things. But I think you can still maybe put on the mind of a beginner and just say, well, what would you want? What's the right thing? This is something Google's great at. It's ingrained in the company. They're also very good at testing. But that's the number one thing. What do I want? What would solve this problem for me? The other thing is, of course, getting as much feedback as possible. This we have with Blogger as well. The flip side of communications and publishing technologies is that you hear a lot from your users. I mean, they're verbose to begin with, and sometimes that they can really let you know what they want loudly. And so that absolutely figures into it. But I think the most important thing is to get people in a room, and we like to create as many. I think it's a very visual. We don't write many things. I tend to write more than other people, but because that's how I figure things out. If I have any idea for something, I try to write about it, and then I figure out if it's a good idea, and then we make pictures and just build stuff. I don't think I have any secrets there, but one thing that I think slows people down, I look back on products that I've been involved in, I think people can sometimes get really hung up on how the current user base or community is going to react, and that makes them hesitant to make changes. And that's really tricky because you, of course, want to respect the wishes of your current users, but you can also get stuck because it can also make you very vulnerable to competition or fast followers because you had 80% of the right idea and you made some choices early on that your current user base finds important, but the 10 times user base doesn't care about that, but you have to continue supporting it, and it keeps you from supporting this other thing or changing how it works. And that's really tricky. I think a lot of people get hung up on that. I think Blogger is a case of that, where we started out with, Blogger was an FTP tool. And it was for web geeks like us who had websites and said, well, we're going to automate publishing a blog to that. And so for a year with Blogger, the first thing you did when you set up a blog is fill in your FTP address and username and password. Obviously, that's not a mainstream tool, but that's what we wanted, so that's what we built. And then we finally added hosting, but we continued to support that along with you go to design your template, and it's a text area of HTML, which isn't exactly a mainstream usage either. And then so other tools came in on both sides of us, some that were much more power user focused, and some that were a lot easier. And that was a tough position to be in because we didn't want to take away the power user features, but to really build something easy to use, it would have been better. We would have grown faster had we taken away power user features.
That was a good answer. Thanks. Callie, I have a question for you. So with whether it's podcasting, video casting, video podcasting, I still don't know what to call it exactly.
Video show, podcasting,
there
whatever.
You go. All right. What would be, to someone who's just getting started, sort of your top really concrete to-dos, like your recommendation, your advice to them, to sort of do as much right as possible right off the bat? Right. What would be some of your recommendations?
I'll jump right on the bandwagon here. Stop talking and just do it. Because, I mean, it just the same way as he was talking about. And he was talking about people talk about it. I'll get emails every day asking exactly what to do to go forward with a video show or an audio show or whatever. And I'll tell them exactly what to do. And I'll talk to them 3 months down the road and they haven't done anything. And that's the most frustrating thing because, I want them to succeed. And that's what I love about new media is that we're not in competition with each other. We're all there to help. Mm-hmm. So ask questions. I'm here. I answer all my email as best as I can. I have advice pages on my website. I'm here for you. And everybody in new media
to my knowledge, is there for everybody else, and we're all willing to help. So ask questions, get, you know, pick each other's brains, and that helps us all grow, and that helps us all move forward and push podcasting and new media forward. And so this is going to sound like just mushy-gushy, but together we can, you know, we can make it bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah. What are some of the advice that you give them that they then ignore and go back to their accounting jobs to contemplate or whatever? What are some of those pieces of advice and or even sort of not to do list? Like, what are some of the, maybe if we could look at that, like, what are some of the biggest mistakes that you see people making when they first get started? Assuming they get started.
Yeah. Promoting too early is a huge mistake, because the first 10 shows at the least, you're going to look back on and say, what the heck was I thinking? Because it's going to be bad. It's going to be bad no matter what. And, you know, we started our show without any prior production experience, both on camera or off. We didn't know what we were doing. And so when we started it, we decided we were going to do a video show. Then we bought the camera. Then we figured out what we were going to do, bought the domain name, and went forward. And so the first 3 months and passed, but the first 3 months were really difficult because we were just trying to figure out what we were doing, and we were growing an audience already, and we still had audio video sync issues. You know, I mean, you go back to the first ones, please don't know. And you see that, you know, that we're out of sync, and people still watched because it was still early in podcasting, but that you don't get as many chances that like that now, you know, so don't promote too early. Get your show underway, whatever format it is that you're going with, test it out, get the kinks out, then start, you know, letting people know about yourself.
Yeah, that's, I think that what you'll find, common, at least to some extent among everybody here, is a sort of ready, fire, aim type of approach to creating products and launching companies. Because you get real user feedback. You're not speculating. And so I was terrified of first blogging. So what many people don't realize is that I actually had a WordPress site that I didn't promote anywhere. I went out of my way not to mention it, that I just tooled around with for a few weeks to get comfortable with the tools, and before I ever launched the blog that some people may be familiar with now. And it's funny because it actually just launched yesterday, the redesign of the blog and the Lifestyle Experiments blog. And the current users, a lot of them came back. And it's not that they necessarily were dependent on features of the blog, but they were comfortable. It was like seeing an old face when they went back there. So as soon as I changed one of the photos, they said, you should rename the blog the Zombie Lifestyle Experiments blog. Since it was a photo of me, I was particularly flattered. It's like, okay. But even in 2 days, those people have already been like, you know what? No, it's fine. So don't be scared off into testing. So what I'd be kind of curious to ask is, and this is open for anybody, but I'll ask Mike. As far as speed is concerned, are there certain things that perhaps you shouldn't do as quickly? So John Wooden, some of you may have heard of John Wooden. He's the first person to be inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame, both as a player and as a coach. Very, very, very intelligent guy. And he's famous for saying, move quickly, but don't hurry. So what are some of the things that you should be particularly aware of not rushing?
So one thing to be careful of, and I have to be particularly careful about it because I am Mr. Ready, Fire, Aim, is internal team morale issues. And I always say that a small team with very high morale is really hard to defeat. They have a very low burn rate, and if they're really, the morale is really that high, then they can go for, you know, 5 months without salary. If the morale is high enough. I mean, people also ask me, what's my favorite business book? My favorite business book is The Six-Day War, The Arab-Israeli War. You should read the book. It's amazing what the Israelis did in 1967. If your morale is high, companies are usually defeated, I think, by internal friction as opposed to external. You know, VP of marketing can't stand the VP of engineering. You know, they hate each other, and they spend so much energy, you know, positioning themselves internally or whatever, as opposed to fighting the, you know, the enemy externally. So I think the key in my mind is just don't rush over sort of internal, you know, friction issues. If there's something happening, like if someone comes into my office and complains about someone else, I say, great, let's walk across the hall and talk to that person. And also the sort of the spiral of, you know, of anger or whatever happens. And a lot of times someone will say something that really, you know, pisses me off, and I have now stopped myself, and I will say, hey, did you mean to say that? Because that, you know, I found that really offensive. They're, no, I didn't mean that. And 80% of the time, they didn't mean to start the cycle. But when you then you get mad at them, you fight them back. And all the time I'm getting people to walk across the hall and, you know, it's going to take 10 minutes. We don't have 10 minutes, but let's take it. Because then, yeah, everyone's happy again, usually. And it saves us so much more time anyway. So in terms of things to actually take time to do is quickly try to go get to the bottom of these things so that morale is high again. Anyway.
Yeah, I'll add one to that as well. So just in terms of reaching influencers, this is very popular. There are like 500,000 books on reaching influencers and using social media. When I came to South by Southwest, as an example, I already told you about having a few points of contact is really what paid off. But don't skimp on the time you spend with someone just so you can get as many business cards as possible. That is exactly, I think, the approach that many authors take, and it's exactly why that approach fails. So when I sent an email to a blogger, if I were forced to do so, so meeting in person was number one, and then email was probably number two, just because bothering people on the phone generally puts them on the defense and makes them unhappy. But each email that I sent, and I did not send that many, probably took me an hour to an hour and a half to craft properly. There was no template involved. I mean, I read their stuff. I knew it inside and out. And if my stuff wasn't relevant, if my ideas weren't relevant, if I wasn't relevant, I didn't email them. So it took a long time to select those people, and it was a rifle shot. And I probably got responses from 80 to 90% of them as a result. And if anybody has a book or a product or something with lots of content, lots of features, find one feature or find five pages that is going to be very interesting to this person, this so-called influencer, and then make it really clear what the connection is and introduce it to them. The other thing I'd like to mention just related to the 4-hour work week is that I really don't think I actively asked anyone in the social media space to review the book. Never. I wanted to explore certain concepts, certain trends, certain phenomena, and offered to either be interviewed or to write guest posts or to do anything to explain different concepts. And as a result, those concepts were attributed to me, which in an effort to explain who the hell I was, because no one knew who I was, author of the 4-hour work week. And that was really all that I wanted, because if people don't believe in the concepts, it doesn't matter how much your product is plugged. It's not going to sell. How much time do we have left? 18 minutes. All right, perfect timing. So I think we should just jump right into Q&A. Do you guys have any questions you want to ask each other before we do that? Or just jump into the audience and leave it to the fray?
Did you have something?
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say one additional thing I wanted to point out. We've got a couple different things here. We've got businesses who have employees and then husband and wife team. Yeah. and individuals. In this new media world, if you're wanting to get into it, there are two different ways we could have gone about it. We could have, you know, gotten venture capital money or whatever and gone that traditional route. But what we did is partner with a company like Podshow, is partnered with somebody who knew what they were doing in the advertising space, because we didn't. And that took us out of that business aspect so that we could concentrate on creating a better and a better show. Because it doesn't matter what buzz we got, whatever, if we didn't have a great show, or if we didn't, you know, at least try, then it doesn't matter, you know, anything else. It's not going to stick. Yeah. Audience isn't going to stick. So I really encourage people to think about whether they want to go after all that themselves or whether they want to partner and team up to do that.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And also, so people often say that, well, you should just focus on what you're good at. Focus on what you're good at. And it's really hard if you're being asked to do 1,000 things. So people usually cope with that in one of two ways. They either add people, get a lot of, I'd say three ways, get a lot of money and then figure out what to do with it, which is not a good idea. Or they will eliminate as much as possible. So I think, you know, one thing, there was a really cool story on Obvious and Evan in a recent issue of Inc. And if I misquote you here, it's pretty common in print publications, but with the adding versus taking away, I'll try to paraphrase and you can correct me. Basically, a lot of people, when they're trying to build a product or improve something, they think about adding and adding and adding. And whereas, I suppose in the process of facilitating coming up with good ideas, they actually also look at subtracting things as a way to improve them. And I think that's really, really, really critically important. So in my case, actually, forget about me. I don't want to talk about me. Warren Buffett, all right, just for arguably the most successful stock investor in the history of the United States, his company, Berkshire Hathaway, I think has the same number of employees that Twitter does, or it did at least when the book, The American, Buffett, what was it called? The Making of an American Capitalist, one of the best books I've read in the last year, by the way. And he talks about that simplification, elimination. You know, don't measure what's measurable, measure what's meaningful. I'm sure there are a lot of there's a lot of sort of analytics masturbation that goes on in the tech world, and it wastes a lot of time. So on that, with that image fresh in your mind, let's go into question and answer. So there's a mic right in the middle there. And just in case, I'll put in a shameless plug here because South by Southwest wanted me to do it. I'm having a book signing at 5 o'clock in the day stage somewhere, so that's going to happen. But the mic is right in the middle there, so please come forward and ask your questions to anybody here.
I just have a question for, I guess, whether it be for Tim or for Mike. You talked, Mike, about getting the absolute best talent possible, you know, regardless of what it takes. I know, Tim, you advocate, you know, different ways to do things inexpensively, outsourcing. How do you sort of reconcile that in a small business that's trying to get the best talent but doesn't quite have the budget or certainly VCs that want to meet with them in a day?
Okay, so in terms of talent recruitment, I saw a study once that said they tried to find some regression analysis of what characteristics successful CEOs have, and they measured everything. You know, was their father an entrepreneur? Was their mother an entrepreneur? Was their father work for the government? Were they the oldest child? You know, how many bedrooms did their house have? All these things. They only found two things. One was they like to bring their chairs with them wherever they move from company to company. And the other was they did an extraordinary job of forming relationships when there was no particular reason for it to be beneficial. Like you form a relationship with a dentist or something, a great friend. Because it turns out like 3 years later you're doing a business where you actually, in some cases, use that relationship. So I think it's really important to create these, you know, huge networks. I have 6,000 people in my Outlook contact database. I have, at any given time, 200 people. I keep an Excel spreadsheet of someone I meet with. Oh, this person's really cool. I'd love to work with them. They could be from anywhere. There's a guy at Direct Hit who turned out to be one of our most successful person. I never worked with him. I played Ultimate Frisbee with him. He was an amazing Ultimate Frisbee player. I said, I'd want to hire that guy. And I got him to move from Kansas City to Boston. And he was like, you want me to do what? And he did, and it was very successful. So in terms of talent, I think the key is to try to do it ahead of time. Try to build keep your list. Any time thinking, okay, who would I hire? If I had to start a company right now, who would I hire? And I try to keep in touch with them.
That's actually a point that I think also is actually really related to speed. Okay, so if you don't want to have to develop the relationships you need when you need them, it's like asking for money when you need it. Don't want to do that either. So just as a real concrete example, I think a lot of people were mystified how a first-time author would get like 20 testimonials from some pretty decent names. And I remember one of them actually wrote on his blog somewhere. His name is Rolf Potts, who's a big name to me. He wrote a book called Vagabonding, which is awesome. And I got in touch with him just because I loved his writing and had highlighted every part of his book. And he wrote on his blog at some point, he's like, yeah, this guy's pretty funny. Like, his book was coming out and he contacted me 10 months beforehand. And whereas usually it's like, I'll get some, now that I blog and the blog's pretty successful, I'll get like 10, 12 books a week. And it's like, hi, please review our book. We'd love if you could put it on our blog. Yeah, so the deadline is 10 days from now. He's got to be kidding me. So if you have that those relationships before you need them, then you can just kind of pull the trigger. And it's very, very fast. Okay.
Okay, so Mike and Tim have already sort of covered this a little bit in mentioning books that have had an effect on them, and I'd like to know if any of you, especially Evan or Callie, could add to that list, not necessarily self-help or things that you've personally written or how to succeed in this specific task, just things that have affected your outlook.
I'll mention one that's related to a topic called Slack. By Tom DeMarco. It's a book basically about how to manage software development. He's a co-author of a book called PeopleWare, which is more well-known. But Slack is interesting in relation to this topic because he talks about you should not have 100% of your time filled because then you're actually a lot less flexible. You need to have empty spaces where you can respond and do creative things. And he takes that about managing people and why you don't want to have people be 100% busy, and you want to have extra people so you can actually respond a lot more quickly that way.
For me, it was The Millionaire Next Door. It inspired me actually to not go to college. Bill Gates, you know, he dropped out of college. I didn't go to college because I knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur and I wanted to do stuff by myself, and I didn't want to spend the time and the money to go through that process to work for somebody else. And so that was really inspiring for me. And of course, the 4-hour work week.
Thank you, Callie.
I never want to work 4 hours, but it has helped me to streamline some processes.
Just a quick thing on the 4-hour work week. It's not about laying on a beach and rubbing cocoa butter on your stomach for the rest of your life. It's about actually creating the time so you can choose what you want to do. Just a quick on the book topic. Read books written by people who are the best at what they do, even if it has nothing to do with your industry. So one of the books, I don't really golf. I tried and I suck at it. It's a lot harder than it looks. But there's a book by Ben Hogan called, I think, The Five Lessons or something like that. It's probably the best little book on how to do something I've ever read. It is just amazing. It's been around for 50 or 60 years and everyone still refers to it. Next question.
You're all here and speaking on this panel because you're super achievers at some level, and you've talked about the value of focus, but how do you balance that with family, with a personal life?
Ooh, Mike?
Yeah,
Mike's good at this.
So, excellent question, and I'm very proud to say I get home at 6:30 every day, and I go for a run every day at lunch. My very first company, I started to realize, maybe I can't go for a run today. It's like, screw that. Every day there's going to be a crisis, so I just make myself go. And there's all these crazy studies.
Mike has two kids.
Two kids, 9 and 11. And I saw one that was really kind of heartbreaking. I hope I don't step on any toes. Said there's a very strong correlation between the number of weeknights a family has dinner together and then the number of, you know, drug abuse, you know, adolescent problems, things like that. And it was like, the regression was like 0.99. You know, if you spend 5 nights together, it's, you know, 0.2% of drug abuse. If you spend 2 nights together, it's like 18% chance of drug abuse among your kids. It's horrible. So that one really stuck with me. I mean, I come home, I have dinner with my kids at 6:30. They go to bed at 8:30, and then I get back online. But for me, dinner was really key.
Side note. I'm quite familiar, as much as I dislike the word happiness, I've looked a lot at the research, you know, from Daniel Gilbert at Harvard and other places, and also some really good Princeton researchers. The two determinants they found of happiness, however you want to measure that, meals with families and friends, and also low expectations. That's a different panel, though. All right. Thank you for the question.
Well, I need to take some of your advice because I'm lucky enough to be able to work with my husband. So, and we don't have kids. We have two chihuahuas, but which are like kids, right? But, you know, I mean, I consider myself very, very happy, and we work constantly. Yeah. But again, we don't have kids, and I don't seriously
messed
know
up real expectations.
I'll leave it there.
All right, next question.
This question is for anybody on the panel. I know in this new media, it's really difficult. You know, we talked a little bit about books and influencers. One of the things that I'm finding the hardest is finding a mentor. You know, somebody that can guide me or just show me how to do things. What is the importance of a mentor, and any tips on finding one?
Okay. Guys, mind if I take a stab at that?
Go for it.
All right, so I knew nothing about social media or blogs or the interweb when I was starting to plan how to launch my book. I knew nothing, but it was one of the few cards I had to play because publishers are just scared stiff by anything with ones and zeros, unless it's a balance sheet with lots of profit, usually coming from less than 5% of the books. Anyway, I digress. So I had to find somebody to teach me about this world, and to mostly prevent me from wasting a lot of time on tech fads and all the crap that people tend to dance around and sing about that passes 2 weeks later. So I think there are a couple of keys. Number one is that you need to be very humble and very, very upfront about that. And I think that part of the reason, so I've had a few pretty high profile bloggers, just because I spend a lot of time with bloggers these days and I find them pretty interesting, say to me, I think you're really interesting because you ask a lot of questions. And I've had a number of people say that. And I ask questions about simple stuff. I remember when I was first meeting people, they'd be like, blah, 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 Ruby on Rails. And I'd be like, and then they'd go on to something else. And I'd be like, hold on. I'm kind of like in the deep end of my ignorance pool. What the hell is Ruby on Rails? And they'd be like, oh, because I'd be at some tech event. And they'd be like, oh, okay. And then they'd try to explain it. And half of the time, they'd have a tough time defining it. And they'd be like, oh, wait a minute. Whenever I didn't know something, I wouldn't pretend. I'd be like, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm really sorry, but can you explain that? Second is, and guys have a tough time with this. Women are generally better at that. Guys are like, yeah, so hi, Mr. Jones. I do this and I do that and I know a lot about all these things. And then it's a real turnoff. Second is make it easy for them to help you. So if you contact a mentor, let's just say randomly for advice, and I do that actually quite a lot with email. A couple things. Number one is if you get a referral from somebody, don't ever say you're friends with somebody they know unless you're actually friends. That's, oh God. That happens to me all the time. It's just like, do you know this person? No idea. Delete. All right. So, but if you get a referral, what I tend to do, so it'll be for whomever, like their name, via the friend, and then colon, like Tim Ferriss, whatever. All right. So it's really obviously not spam. And then first two lines, who you are, if there's anything you can say for credibility. That's the first thing. It's like when I talk to my assistant, so I've outsourced all my email and talk about it a lot, this email stuff. And so my assistant in Canada calls me once every day. We have a 10-minute call to go through action items. And the first, every bullet point is, who are they and what do they want from me? So that's it. And those are the two questions that people ask when they're reading email, if they're really busy. Try to, one or two sentences, who you are, and then really quickly, short email. Here's my question. I've tried to do this, this, and this, but I can't find a good answer. Right? Can you help me with this very specific question? If it requires them to write more than two sentences, then you're probably not going to get a response. And I get emails, God, or comments, it's like, hey, can you fix my life? Or, hey, I want to build a blog. Can you find some designers for me? It's like, all right, if you can do it in 5 seconds on Google, don't waste my time. So make sure that you've exhausted your options before you contact them.
And also, I'd say, don't be afraid to set your expectations high. Talk about expectations, but...
You'll be really fast, but not very happy.
But, if there's one person that seems out of reach, go for it. You never know.
Yeah, completely. I totally, totally agree with that. And yeah, I mean, sorry, I'm going to hog the mic for a second. But when I guest lecture at Princeton twice a year in high-tech entrepreneurship, and one of the parts that I go over is how to basically get a hold of just about anybody, how to recruit mentors. And I've had people just with like 5 minutes of goading and hear a couple of recommendations, get responses from George Bush Sr., CEO of Comcast, CEO of Google. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And like, yes, they're students at Princeton, but honestly, it's still pretty hard. And they're able to reach these people and get responses. If you send a FedEx overnight letter to Warren Buffett, I know people have gotten handwritten responses from him. All right. Next question.
This is for Evan or Mike. When your company's getting to the point where you're growing really quickly and you're staffing up, how are you guys dealing with the kind of culture issues that sometimes happen, the inefficiency where new people are having to learn rather than produce? And
I'd love to hear Mike's.
No, I'll let Evan answer. My quick answer. my quick answer is I just sell the company at that point. But Evan, I'll
it can be tough. I think Mike's answer is great. Get them working as soon as possible. And I know some other entrepreneur friends of mine really focus on say like having lunch together with the rest of the team all the time, catering and lunch, spending money in ways that cause people to just hang out together. And it's not, we haven't had too much trouble with people coming up to speed. And hopefully if you hire the right people, I've also never grown a very big company. So.
All right. This is going to be the last question. Cause we're running out of time, but hold on. Don't run away yet. I don't know, how much time when do we actually have to clear out of here? Okay, a little bit. All right, so hang out. We might get to you. I'll push it as long
as I can.
Maybe we
should have a speed round.
Yeah. Right. Technology speed dating. All right, next question.
Aloha. My girlfriend and I run our own company, much like Callie and Neil. And 6 years ago, we visited Hawaii. And 5 years ago, we decided to move there. But we still find ourselves falling into the struggle with working 18 hours a day because we own our own company, we work together, those type of things. What I'm curious about, mostly from Tim, from a lifestyle point of view, but from anybody that's willing to answer, is what do you find yourself falling back into that you constantly have to readjust, redirect?
Okay, I'll take a stab at it, I guess, since I'm like the designated lifestyle guy. I would say even checking email when I don't have to.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, all right, if you're a recovering alcoholic, you don't want to go to a bar, right? That's the equivalent of being on email detox and coming to South by Southwest. It's just like, Jesus, everybody's screen sucking everywhere. You feel like you should. There's an expression somebody told me when I was bitching and moaning about this. They're like, well, in Alcoholics Anonymous, they say, if you don't want to slip, don't go where it's slippery, right? So I'm failing that pretty badly. But the key to keeping a lot of that in check, I find, is number one, creating a not-to-do list. So identifying what your crutch activities are and really reviewing that not-to-do list even more than your to-do list. Because honestly, there's probably not more than one or two really important things that you need to do. But again, sort of socially reinforced cramming of Outlook calendars. Both Warren Buffett... sorry, I'm like on this whole Warren Buffett trip. But Warren Buffett and Arnold Schwarzenegger, and God, there's one more that I'm missing... neither of them have set calendars. Oh, I know who it is. Mark Andreessen, also. He may have somewhat of a set calendar, but not very much. It's like having the freedom to focus on what's important without being pre-committed to all these sort of arbitrary bullshit meetings and phone calls and stuff that you put in there to feel productive. So here, just real quick, if you have to choose between feeling bored or feeling productive, you're going to choose feeling productive even if you're not productive. That's why people wake up and they check email first thing on a Saturday and end up doing it for 5 hours and then just being stressed out for the rest of the weekend. No. So in order not to feel bored, you have to actually schedule something non-work related that is interesting and compelling, right? If checking email is more compelling than sitting on your couch watching reruns of Family Guy, then you're going to check your email. So actually design a lifestyle. This is my thing, right? But like schedule bracketing activities that either begin the day or end the day or end the work week. So you have something scheduled. If you're really sort of deep into the addiction, then you can do things like prepay for cooking classes or a gym membership or a personal trainer, just so you have this guilt associated with not going to those, just like you'd feel guilty for not checking email. So that'd be a couple of tips.
Great.
All right, next question.
Hey, all right. Real quick, how do you find users if your product is something that everyone uses? For instance, I'm in the property space, and it's a website that facilitates renting property, but everyone lives in property. You know, so how would you? Any tips for parsing people out? And
does that mean no one needs your product?
No, everyone needs the product.
So do you mean it's a commodity not in a negative sense, but it's just a very common product? Or?
Everyone lives somewhere in a house. Mm-hmm. And
what are you website, selling? Just like exactly what?
It's like we facilitate owners of property to rent out their property to users or renters.
Okay. Anybody want to take a stab? I mean, I have some ideas, but... Okay, I'll go. All right, I'll go for it. So if you look at Zipcar, the same issue that Edmonton, they really got hyper local. So they were spread out in a bunch of different places, and they just focused on like segmenting out one neighborhood in New York City, for example, and dominating it. So they had basically a surround sound effect, which is what I did, by the way, in sort of the tech blog world and in other places.
Same thing I was talking about earlier with Twitter about really focusing. For a while.
Yeah. I mean, choose your channel and choose your location. Just dominate it, and then that expands it. But if you have this marginal interaction with different markets or different people, same poor effect. You know what? If you want to talk more about it, I can share some ideas at the signing as well. I'm going to break the rules and do one more because there's only one more guy. Sorry.
Thanks. Aaron Dragishin, Ask 500 People. I'm wondering, Tim, you talked about sending something to an author 10 months in advance, and Mike, you talked about scheduling with VCs, so they're making a decision in one day. Obviously, you guys are going in very prepared, and I'm wondering what happens after you've launched. I mean, you've got all this build-up to be able to do something really fast on the fly when it comes to it, when it really counts. What happens after you launch, and all of a sudden you've got these other variables, everything's crashing down on you, and everything's, you know, you're very busy now. How do you manage being prepared for the next things?
That's going to be a Mike or Evan question, I think.
I keep my to-do list on an Excel spreadsheet, and I resort it every night, and I have a prioritization of sort of long-term, short-term things. And one trap that everyone is aware of probably is if you just focus on the short-term things all the time, you never get to the long-term things. So if something is on a long-term thing, my spreadsheet will bump it up to become a short-term thing for that day, whatever, if it's been on the long-term list too long. Once it gets on your short-term list, for me, it has to get that done that day. So just make sure your long-term things get into your short-term queue, I guess.
The thing that I'm constantly trying to do is just ask, does this matter? Does this matter? And once you have attention on you, you'll get tons of emails and tons of opportunities, and opportunities are very tantalizing, but there's very few that really matter to your business or matter to your future. And you just got to practice that, exercising that no muscle.
Yeah, this is actually one thing that I've been focusing on a lot recently. So the most popular post on my blog right now is, I didn't expect it either, it's called The Art of Letting Bad Things Happen. And basically it talks about the reality, which is there are going to be, every day is going to be a crisis. There's never a good time to do anything important. You know, whether it's have a kid or quit a job or start a company, there's never a good time. And so what I've realized is that you have to ask yourself, you know, can I let these supposedly urgent things fail? A lot of them are usually manufactured emergencies from other people or tantalizing opportunities that are really irrelevant. Can I let these things fail temporarily, even for one day, just to block out everything and get to that next milestone with that one or the one or two things that really matter? And recognizing that most things that are urgent, not all, but most things that fail, like if you miss paying your cable bill for 20 days in order to, you know, or dropping off the DVD in order to do something important, all those things are reversible. The damage is reversible. And if they're not, it's usually pretty minute. If you miss a colleague because you want to spend a weekend with your kids instead of responding to his or her urgent email on Saturday night, I remember this happened to one person I know. And she ignored it. She came into the office Monday morning. This person's like, why didn't you respond to my email? Oh my God, did you get it was so urgent. And she goes, what happened? I mean, I'm sorry, but you know, it's with my family, but you know, what bad happened? I'll help you fix it. And she goes, well, no, but it was really urgent. So I think email is like, evalidate. It's like, make me feel important. So, wow, I got on a huge tangent there. Anyway, hopefully that helps. But I think that a lot of the stuff gets thrown at you. You just need to block out and focus on the few things that you predefined as important.
Thanks very much.
Yeah. Thank you so much, guys. Thanks to our panelists, please.